Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The Global Story is the podcast helping you make sense of the news. Join me, Katya Adler, every weekday as I take a closer look at the stories making the headlines with insights from the BBC's global network of experts. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Monday, the 11th of December, these are our main stories. At his swearing-in ceremony, the new president of Argentina, Javier Milei, has said the country needs shock treatment to bring it out of its economic crisis. The World Health Organization has adopted a resolution calling for immediate medical access and humanitarian aid for Gaza. The International Committee of the Red Cross says one of its convoys, which was clearly marked, has been attacked in Sudan, killing two people and injuring seven. Also in this podcast,
one of only 12 red dwarf tomatoes germinated and grown to ripeness on the craft went missing.
So, is it a case of lost in space? What happened to this unique specimen grown in the International Space Station? Argentina's new president, Javier Milei, says shock treatment is needed to deal with the country's severe economic crisis. After being sworn in, he pledged to bury decades of failure. From Buenos Aires is our South America correspondent, Katie Watson.
Javier Milei was sworn in to huge applause, chants of yes he can and freedom from those who voted for him. This is a new political path that Argentina's embarking on, as he reflected himself in his speech shortly afterwards.
Hoy comienza una nueva era en Argentina. Hoy damos por terminada.
Today begins a new era for Argentina. Today ends a long and sad history of decadence and decline, and we start the journey of rebuilding our country. There's no going back. Today we bury decades of failure.
Mr. Milei has been hugely critical of traditional politics in Argentina. Just as the Berlin Wall marked the end of a tragic period for the world, he said, these elections have marked a tipping point for Argentina's history. But most of Javier Milei's speech was dedicated to the country's economic crisis. Argentina's facing 150% annual inflation, and 4 in 10 Argentinians now live in poverty. He warned that cuts would be coming, delivering on his campaign promise of slashing government spending. There's an alternative to the shock, he said. Argentina has no money. And this, he admitted, would have an impact on wages, the economy and poverty. There's no doubt his honeymoon period will be short. Argentinians are fed up of hoping for change.
Katie Watson reporting. I asked Katie if Mr. Milei could manage to take both pragmatic steps, such as appointing a former central banker as his economy minister, and at the same time please his voters who supported him because of his radical ideas.
The fact that he's shown a bit more pragmatism, well, that might disappoint those people who wanted him to be a bit more extreme. It might reassure those people who were worried that his radical policies would make things worse. But that's the issue. I think Javier Milei has to tread very carefully. A country in crisis, people are fed up. They want improvement and they want to see it fast. It's interesting. Luis Caputo is the new economy minister, and he's a former central bank governor. And of course, Javier Milei said he wanted to blow up the central bank, so that probably needs some negotiating. He comes from more of a traditional conservative background. He worked for Macri, who was a conservative who lost in 2019. So he's clearly taking advice from people who've already been in positions of power in the economy and positions of power on the right. So he's trying to forge a way forward, whether that's going to be dollarization, probably not quite yet, probably not blowing up the central bank either. But I mean, these are all discussions that need to be put on the table straight away. I don't think anybody really has an idea exactly how he's going to achieve this. I mean, people have tried before and failed, and that's going to be his biggest challenge. It's going to be a difficult few years. So he's made that very clear in a speech that it's not going to be easy going forward.
Katie Watson. The World Health Organization has adopted a resolution calling for immediate humanitarian aid for Gaza. Speaking before the meeting in Geneva, the WHO's chief, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said the war there was having a catastrophic impact on healthcare.
1.9 million people have been displaced. almost the entire population of the Gaza Strip and are looking for shelter anywhere they can find it. But nowhere and no one is safe in Gaza. As more and more people move to a smaller and smaller area, overcrowding combined with the lack of adequate food, water, shelter and sanitation are creating the ideal conditions for disease to spread.
Well, the Hamas-run health ministry says 18,000 people have now been killed across Gaza, nearly 300 of those within the last 24 hours. Israel, meanwhile, has reiterated that it is committed to minimising civilian casualties. It's telling people to leave the southern city of Khan Yunis, where fighting has continued to intensify. Our Middle East correspondent Hugo Bashega reports.
A desperate father searches for his son at the Nasser hospital in Khan Yunis after another night of intense Israeli attacks. Fighter jets have continued to pound the city as Israeli tanks advance from two directions. Fierce fighting is also happening in the north, with the Israeli military carrying out operations in Jabalia and Shijaya. Across the territory, the humanitarian situation is catastrophic, according to the UN. It says half of Gaza's population is starving. Filippi Lazzarini is the head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees.
People are psychologically broke today. Everything has been destroyed. And most of the people I'm meeting there, they say, I don't see my future anymore in Gaza. I have enough. My children have known only war.
He also accused Israel of trying to engineer the mass expulsion of Gazans into Egypt by pushing people to the south of the territory and depriving the population of humanitarian aid. The claims were dismissed by an Israeli government spokesman as outrageous and false. With dozens of Palestinians being killed every day, pressure is growing on Israel to do more to protect civilians. But the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has again rejected proposals for a ceasefire. Addressing his cabinet, he said countries couldn't support the elimination of Hamas and at the same time put pressure on Israel to end the war, which would prevent the elimination of Hamas. Reports on Israeli media say officials believe intense operations will continue until early February. If the Israeli tactics don't change, thousands more in Gaza won't be alive by then.
Hugo Bashega. The 2023 Nobel Peace Prize was handed out on Sunday, but this year's winner, Narges Mohammadi, wasn't there to receive the award at the ceremony in Oslo City Hall. She was detained in Iran in 2021 and is currently serving a 10-year sentence in Tehran's Evin prison. Bahman Kalbasi from the BBC's Persian service watched the ceremony in the Norwegian capital.
In a moving and what will be likely a historic moment for the human rights defenders in Iran, a city of Oslo hosted its annual Nobel Peace Prize event and awarded the prize to a human rights defender behind bars. Narges Mohammadi has spent better half of the last two decades in prison because of her criticism of the Iranian government, and that made her one of the only five people in the history, 120 plus years history of the Nobel Institution, that has not been able to receive her award in person. This is part of the speech by the chair of the Nobel Prize Committee, who spoke about why Narges Mohammadi was very much qualified to get this award.
By focusing on women's rights, Narges Mohammadi is highlighting the universal right to equality. She has fought restrictions imposed on women, such as the forced wearing of the hijab and other covering garments, as well as prohibitions involving sports, dance, and movement in general.
Narges Mohammadi's children, 17-year-old twins Ali and Kiana, received the award on her behalf. There was an empty chair for her where the award was placed as a symbol of her absence. The children also read her message to the international community, in which she denounced the tyranny of the Iranian government.
Je suis l'une de millions de femmes iraniennes fières et résistantes.
I'm one of millions of proud and resistant Iranian women who stood up against injustice, repression, discrimination, and tyranny. I remember the women, anonymous and courageous, who led a life of resistance in different areas despite merciless repression. I write this message behind the high, cold walls of a prison. I'm a woman from the Middle East, from a region which, although heir to a rich civilization, is currently trapped in war and prey to the flames of terrorism and extremism.
That report was by Bahman Kalbasi. Now to the United States. It's an American landmark, an iconic Los Angeles landmark, to be precise. But did you know the Hollywood sign is 100 years old, and so is Tinseltown? And if it needed any excuse, it's celebrating. Millions of people visit this tourist attraction every year, hoping for a photo or selfie. Wendy Urquhart reports.
Hooray for Hollywood. That's gooey, bally, hooly Hollywood. Where any office boy or young mechanic can be a panic with just a good-looking pan.
The Hollywood Sign Trust celebrated the 100-year milestone by lighting up the Hollywood Sign letters with the original 4,000 vintage bulbs that illuminated the real estate sign Hollywood Land in 1923. They also bought 400 gallons of white paint to give the letters a makeover, which is no mean feat considering each one is 14 metres tall and at least 9 metres wide. Adam Burke, who's CEO of the Los Angeles Tourism and Convention Board, says the sign not only looks pristine, it generates billions of dollars for local businesses.
The Hollywood sign really is our global icon. It is the reason people choose to come to LA, not just because of getting that bucket list photo with a Hollywood sign in the background, but also because it represents the fact that LA is a city of endless possibility. The local business community received over $34 billion in sales last year from visitors to L.A.
It's hard to believe that way back in the 1800s, Hollywood, California was a wasteland where cowboys roamed and livestock grazed. But when people living on the eastern seaboard started to drift west in search of sunny skies and a drier climate, it sparked a boom in real estate. And the wife of the town founder, Harvey Wilcox, suggested the iconic name after meeting a woman who'd called her Florida summer home Hollywood. When atrocious weather forced a tiny Chicago company to head to California to finish a shoot in 1907, other film companies took note. And within 5 years, film companies were springing up all over the place, turning old barns and derelict buildings into sparkling studios. The sign became the property of the city in the 1940s, but by then it was very dilapidated and several of the letters were falling apart. In 1978, a fundraiser by Playboy founder Hugh Hefner was a huge success, with individual letters auctioned off at around $28,000 each. The glitterati loved it, and before long, the old sign had been replaced with a brand new one. Now the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce, the City of Los Angeles, and the Hollywood Sign Trust are responsible for the maintenance and repair of what is undoubtedly Hollywood's biggest star.
That report was by Wendy Urquhart. Still to come.
Walnuts blanched in warm water. Then take a quantity of rue, which is a herb, and an equal quantity of bay leaf. Beat together, put into a fig, and then eat it.
A medieval remedy to ward off plagues, discovered as a university library digitizes its ancient manuscripts.
Something mysterious plagues County Mayo on the west coast of Ireland and its legendary Gaelic football team.
I believe in the curse. Yeah, I think it's real.
Is it just superstition? Or could there be more to it?
Sometimes I think there's something sinister going on.
What do we need to do to win an All-Ireland final for Mayo?
Listen to the curious tale of the Mayo Curse on Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service. Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. 3 days of voting got underway on Sunday for millions of people in Egypt's presidential election, with Abdel Fattah al-Sisi all but certain to win a third term. There are three other candidates. All are relative unknowns. The election is being held against a backdrop of economic crisis. President Sisi's supporters have been trying to project a message of stability and optimism. Sally Nabil reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
A decade ago, many Egyptians took to the streets to celebrate the man they then saw as their savior. Huge posters of Abd al-Fattah al-Sisi were hung all over Cairo. But today, the general turned president faces a very different reality. Nadia is a proud mother of six. The 57-year-old widow can hardly make a living selling newspapers in a small kiosk. In her modest flat in one of Cairo's populous slums, we chat while she's doing the dishes in her tiny kitchen. I can see the pain in her eyes when she says she hasn't been able to afford meat in 3 years.
Cooking a meal used to cost 60 or 70 pounds. Now it costs between 300 and 500. Sometimes I'm too scared to go to bed because I know that the next morning prices will go up. We don't have a future. It's swallowed up by price hikes. No one thinks of the poor. No one sees us.
Since President Sisi took power, vast sums of money have been allocated to huge infrastructure projects. Wherever you go in Cairo, you see flyovers being built, roads being expanded, let alone the new capital that has cost billions of dollars and is still barely inhabited. Critics believe this approach has drained Egypt's financial resources. But supporters say such rapid urban expansion has helped create jobs and will eventually usher in more prosperous times. Since March 2023, the Egyptian pound has lost more than 50% of its value against the dollar. President Sisi's human rights record has also drawn widespread criticism.
I would really love to tell you that I'm...
Mina is a human rights activist who has been living in a self-imposed exile in the UK for nearly 6 years.
The human rights business in Egypt is very dangerous. Me, as a human rights defender and a human rights researcher, I can't do my work freely without fear of prosecution, of fear of being sent back to jail. Many of my colleagues still under travel ban, their assets are frozen.
The state has long dismissed such criticism as politicized. This presidential election is largely seen as a one-horse race. The potential opposition front-runner, former MP Ahmed Tantawi, is on trial, facing charges of printing and circulating election papers without authorization. These days in Cairo, banners hanging everywhere try to convince voters that a new term for Mr. Sisi means better days to come. But many Egyptians wonder if anything will really change.
Sally Nabil reporting from Cairo. The International Committee of the Red Cross says it is shocked by a deliberate attack on a humanitarian convoy in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. It said two people were killed and seven injured. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, reports.
The International Committee of the Red Cross said vehicles clearly marked with the organisation's emblem were due to evacuate over 100 civilians to safety when they came under attack. It said both the Sudanese army and the rapid support forces had earlier given security guarantees. A statement from the army blamed the aid agency. Meanwhile, once again, we're being told that the army chief, Abdul Fattah al-Burhan, and the RSF leader, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, are ready to talk peace. But many similar statements have come to nothing. The feuding generals jointly staged a coup 2 years ago that halted Sudan's transition to democracy.
Will Ross. The brother of Diana, Princess of Wales, has accused BBC senior managers of trying to hide behind lawyers to prevent the release of thousands of emails relating to an interview with his late sister. The former BBC journalist Martin Bashir faked documents to secure the interview in 1995, in which Diana famously said there were three people in her marriage to the then Prince Charles. Our culture correspondent Charlotte Gallagher told me more about the emails.
These emails relate to a two-month period in 2020. Martin Bashir was back at the BBC but was on sick leave. And this was the time when questions were really mounting about his interview with Princess Diana and how he secured it. Of course, Nick, we now know he secured that interview through deception and faking documents. Now, an investigative journalist called Andy Webb used a Freedom of Information request here in the UK to try to access the emails of senior managers and Martin Bashir over that two-month period in 2020. He wanted to know what they knew about Martin Bashir and what they were doing. When he received a small number of emails, he then went to a judge. It's emerged that there were, in fact, over 3,000 emails sent in that two-month period. However, the BBC are saying that they are irrelevant or contain legally privileged information. But the judge has said to them, you do have to release a large number of these emails now to this journalist. He also criticised the BBC for the way it handled the case, saying it was inconsistent, erroneous and unreliable, saying it was a cause for serious concern. Princess Diana's brother, Earl Spencer, he believes there has been a cover-up at the top of the BBC.
It's about people who are still in power in the BBC who have taken decisions that I question and the judge has certainly questioned. As is often the case in these things, it's the cover-up, not the actual origins of such a case that becomes more increasingly worrying. But I see this as a point of principle. I believe the BBC should be guarded by responsible senior figures and not hidden behind to protect their careers.
So, Charlotte, what else has the BBC been saying?
They've issued a statement, Nick, saying that they accept mistakes were made in this case in the past and they are working to improve their processes. They say they have also apologised to Andy Webb and the tribunal.
Charlotte Gallagher. The library of Trinity College in the Irish capital, Dublin, is renowned throughout the world for its collection of medieval manuscripts. The most famous is the Book of Kells, an illuminated manuscript containing the four biblical New Testament Gospels. But the library is also home to at least 600 other precious medieval manuscripts, dating from the 5th to the 16th centuries and with origins across Western Europe. On Thursday, a project was launched to put the manuscripts online so that the public could have free access to them. 60 of the manuscripts have now been digitised into about 16,000 high-quality images. Paul Henley spoke to Estelle Gittings, the manuscript curator at the Library of Trinity College. She sent him some of the images to look at, so he began by asking her about the language of the manuscripts that he found hard to decipher.
That we're talking about are actually in Latin, but often you'll find more than one language in a single manuscript. So one of them, the Matthew Paris Book of St. Albans, is in Latin, but also French. It also has annotations in English.
Can you tell which manuscripts will be in highest demand?
You often can't tell in advance, but we often find the really visual ones attract an awful lot of attention, and we've got some proper beauties that have been digitized. So we have a lot of images of medieval people working. We have medieval kings, but then ordinary people as well. Lots of animals, lots of beautiful, colorful images of animals. But then we've also got a lot of manuscripts that are less decorative, but they are really informative for how people lived their everyday lives in the medieval period.
So not just religious writing, we're talking about medicinal recipes. What else?
That's right. There are religious books. There's very lavish books made for very important, very rich people. But then there are also collections of much smaller, really useful texts, texts that would be important for, say, a religious community. But then there's also dictionaries. In some other books, they've been reused. So you will find recipes. You'll find recipes or cures for ailments. So if someone has a sore mouth or a sore back, for example, we've got cures for that. We've also got one for the plague, which is really quite interesting.
Tell me about that.
Well, I've actually got a little transcription of it here, and it seems quite simple, and the ingredients almost seem quite modern. And it reads, walnuts blanched in warm water, then take a quantity of rue, which is a herb, and an equal quantity of bay leaf, beat together, put into a fig, and then eat it. And that's apparently to ward off plague. So that sounds really doable.
Not quite convincing either. There's advice on the benefits of eating cheese, I hear.
There is. In another one of the manuscripts, there's a text on the medicinal properties of cheese, but then it's bound within a volume with lots of other little texts. And another one of them actually has a cat's paw print where a cat has walked over the manuscript whilst the scribe was either writing it and the cat wanted his attention, or somebody had left it open when they were reading it.
Not all these manuscripts originate in Ireland. Some are from the Netherlands, Italy. How did Trinity College Dublin end up having them?
Trinity College Dublin was founded in 1592 by Elizabeth I, and there was a library pretty much since it was founded. And there were a number of people who were involved in the setting up of the college who were buying books at the time. And a lot of these books would have been in circulation after the Reformation. So after, in particular in Britain, after the monasteries were all closed down, there was a big book trade and people were buying for universities like Oxford and Cambridge and Trinity College Dublin.
Estelle Gittings from Trinity College Library in Dublin. And finally, some good news for one NASA astronaut who'd been living under a cosmic cloud of suspicion after a tomato went missing on the International Space Station. Stephanie Prentice has the story.
The astronaut Frank Rubio returned to Earth in September after spending a record 371 days in space. But this achievement was marred by suspicions he'd eaten a precious resource while up there. One of only 12 red dwarf tomatoes germinated and grown to ripeness on the craft went missing on his watch. They were the first of the fruit ever grown in space. Frank Rubio said he remembered Velcroing the tomato in place after being given it, but returned to find it gone. He said he searched for it for 20 hours and pointed out the weightless environment meant it could have floated off anywhere on the space station, which is larger than a six-bedroom house. His colleagues up there had their own ideas, speculating that he'd eaten it and branding him a tomato thief. Now, 2 months after the unfortunate incident, his otherwise spotless record has been reinstated after the team currently up there revealed they'd made a discovery.
Our good friend Frank Rubio, who headed home, has been blamed for quite a while for eating the tomato, but we can exonerate him. We found the tomatoes.
Good news for Team Morale and good news for Frank, who prior to being known as a tomato thief was seen as a pioneer in his field, leading NASA's veggie program. Where the tomato had been all this time or what state the rogue fruit was found in are yet to be revealed. But it's probably safe to say none of Frank's colleagues would be tempted to eat it.
Stephanie Prentice. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Leah McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles. And until next time, goodbye.